Welcome to Cooper Talk. I'm your host, Steve Cooper, and remember, I'm only as hip as my guests. And I got to tell you, people, the gentleman on my show today, I saw his band, Blue Oyster Cult, play at the Spectrum in Philadelphia in 1981 and 1984. And in the same time, in June of 81, they played as Soft White Underbelly at a club called Emerald City in Cherry Hill. And I wanted to go, and my parents wouldn't let me because I was in high school. And they have a new album out called Ghost Stories, and it's Buck Darman. How you doing, Buck?
I'm good, Steve. Glad to talk to you.
Yeah, I got to ask you real quick. You guys were selling out arenas. I saw you in Philadelphia. And then you did this small tour of clubs in between. Was that like a workshop tour? And because you went to Soft White Underbelly? Or what was that about?
We actually enjoy playing clubs in small rooms. So, you know, even when we were in arenas. So, yeah, we would do that. We do it just basically for the fun of it.
Okay, so now tell
no
me about
real purpose. You know, it's not like we're comedians trying out new material or stuff. It was just we did it because we liked it.
How do you? I mean, as I said, this was in '81 when you played that club, and I was so pissed because my parents were like, "You're 17, you can't go into a bar."
And you couldn't get into a bar, I guess, right?
Yeah. So how do you adjust though when you're used to playing to a big venue and then all of a sudden it's smaller because it the energy's got to be different.
It is. We actually had to learn to play in arenas because, you know, you don't know that till you actually do it. And you don't do it till you can actually, you know, command an arena audience. So, you know, we learned how to project to a big crowd when opening for Alice Cooper on the Killer Tour when we were first out of the box with Blue Oyster Cult. And seeing how Alice and his band did it, you know, was a real instruction for us. You know, that's how we learned how to do it.
Now tell me about the album Ghost Stories. It's music from 78 to 83. You're just off your 50th anniversary. What was the decision to bring this material up? Was, as I could say, workshopped or practiced or not finished? What was the thought process?
Yeah, those are pre-production sessions. And we hadn't realized we had those recordings. They were in the possession of George Geranius, who was our live sound mixer for a couple decades, and he had the pre-production tapes. And Frontiers Records wanted some more material from us, and we weren't prepared to give them an album of new material, but we knew that George had those recordings, and we pitched them on the idea. Frontiers, that is, on the idea of bringing those songs up to commercial release quality in 2024, and they were enthusiastic about that. So here we are, and it features all the original members of the band. You know, the deceased Alan Lanier and the Bouchard brothers, Albert and Joe.
So how did you go about it? Did you the studio process? Did you guys end up putting some added work on it now, or what was their whole process?
George did a good job of recording them originally, and he had posted his mix of a lot of these songs on his YouTube channel. And then when we got the audio, which George had digitized, some of the tapes had deteriorated. Some of them were stereo and had to be sort of demixed using the AI software that's available now, where you can just get more control over the individual elements, you know, the drums, the bass, the guitars, the vocals. So that was done. Albert and Joe contributed new recordings on their songs to complete them and polish them. And all the work was done by Richie Castellano and Steve Shank. I actually had very little to do with the nuts and bolts of this record at all.
Now, looking back at it, how do you feel about the material? Because we all grow. I do stand-up comedy. I did it for a long time, got out of the business. I'm back in the business again. And the stuff I did years ago, I wouldn't do now. I just, because I'm also, I just turned 60. I'm not a 24-year-old kid in a, you know, hanging out just out of college. So when I look back at my material, I understand, yeah, it was funny, but I look at it differently. How do you look at it when you look back to this material from like 78 through 83? This is years later and you're in a completely different part of your life.
Yeah. When I listen to Ghost Stories, it sounds to me like it could be a long lost Blue Oyster Cult record from that period of time. Say, you know, maybe the master was destroyed or something, and then somebody comes up with a copy of it, you know, 40 years later, and then it comes out. But it sounds period correct to me, you know, as far as a Blue Oyster Cult record. It's got all the original members. It's got the flavor of the Columbia years of recordings.
So you recently came out with the, you celebrated your 50th anniversary, which to me, it just amazes me because people don't stay on jobs for 50. I mean, you can get a pension after 25 years of some jobs.
Oh, yeah, that's really, old timers used to do that. You know, it's not the way it is today.
So what was that like doing that show for the album? It was, you know, you released it the first night. I mean, what's the feeling when you look and go, wow, like 50 years?
Well, it was a love fest, you know, with the fans, you know, because everyone that was in that room, you know, I've really made the effort to stay with the band and they, you know, they really get a lot from the band and we get a lot from the fans. So it was it took quite a bit of rehearsal to play like we did on the first record and the second record and the third record, you know, going back, because the band obviously has evolved personally. You know, my style of playing has evolved, and to play the parts that I recorded in 1972 and 75, you know, that period was actually took some effort. You know, I played a lot more flashy in those days than I do now.
So what do you think it is with your fans that they know all your obscure bits? They all, you know, and a lot of people come and go with bands. Music trends change, they disappear. But what is it? My friend Mark Esposito, I grew up with, is like the biggest fan of you guys ever. I think he bought you a whiskey at a bar in Connecticut one time after a show.
Yeah, and I think I know Marcus. Yeah.
But what is it that makes your fans just love you? I mean, is it because you appreciate them, or what do you think it is?
I don't know. I think what BOC does is sort of unique. You know, we're not like any other band, and I imagine that other bands have fans like ours. You know, I don't know, but I suppose that they do. But of course, the internet has been a great communication level for artists and their audiences. You know, and I imagine that I can't imagine I would be as close to the fans as I am without the internet. You know, we've all got bullet boards and forums and things like that. And we started out with AOL and in the 90s, and it's grown from then. And so I bet it's similar with other bands, but I don't know. But it's, of course, it's great to have a personal relationship with fans. We have, our fans are, in my opinion, you know, very rational people. There's very few, you know, crazy people or nuts or people you'd like to avoid. Most of the fans are, you know, really nice folks. You know, and I've gotten to be pretty good friends with quite a few of them.
So you're working on a solo song, right?
Yes.
Okay, so tell me about that, because you did one a long time ago, but what made you decide to do this right now?
Yeah, actually, it's my version of a song that I wrote for the Spirits Burning project, which Albert Bouchard got me into, and it's called The End of Every Song. And the audio is done. I'm finishing the video now. When the video comes out, I'm going to put it up on the streaming services and the video services also.
So when did you first start writing songs? That always fascinates me, because you've written like the biggest Blue Oyster Cult hits you've written, you know, Don't Fear the Reaper, Godzilla, Burning for You. When did you start writing songs? I mean, I know you were in college when the band started, but did you always want to be a musician, and did you go to college for something to fall back on? Because I did that when I went to college for business, and when I got out, I sold fax machines and I started doing the comedy circuit, but I told my parents I'd get a degree. But when did you decide that you wanted to create music? Was it as a kid?
I like to play music. I didn't really think about writing music until I had met Sandy Pearlman, and he suggested that we might have some success or opportunity as a original music band. Before that, I hadn't written anything. And in what became the Soft White Underbelly, which became Blue Oyster Cult, is when I started creating music myself. You know, I was happy to play other people's music before that. So I went to school to be a chemical engineer just because I liked chemistry and I had an aptitude for the tech stuff. And that's where I coincidentally met Albert Bouchard, and who was the original drummer and creative force, you know, with everybody else in Blue Oyster Cult. So that was none of my life is intentional as far as career path or anything. I just, a door would open and I would walk through it, basically, is what happened.
Now, how did you guys get your first record deal? Because it's so different now. I talk to musicians. I mean, it's the music industry is completely different. I mean, as you said, you can do something in your home studio. You can pop it on the internet. You could get a million likes. You could get it on, you could just sell. But how is it for you guys getting the first record deal? What was the music climate like back then?
Well, I think you had to live in New York or L.A. basically at that time. Nashville, of course, was happening for country music, but it hadn't been the universal music city that it is now. But I think you really had to be in the places where it was being created and marketed. That's, you know, bands would get a reputation from elsewhere and maybe get signed. But if you really wanted to get signed, you had to be where it was. So because Sandy Pearlman was one of the first rock journalists, he was already being courted by the promotion departments of record companies to, you know, promote existing acts. So he was able to talk to the labels, and he got us demo time, and we made demos for Mercury, we made demos for Atlantic, we made demos for Columbia twice before we got signed. And we originally got signed to Elektra when we were the Underbelly, you know, and we did some recordings for them, but we had a falling out with the label, basically with Sandy, the management of Elektra didn't agree with him, so the recordings were fallow. They laid unused for I don't know what happened to them, and then all of a sudden Rhino released them about 30 years later. So
now, do you remember the first time you heard yourself on the radio? Because that must be such a great feeling as a musician.
Yeah, we had one play on WABC AM with Cities on Flame from the first album. And it was, I guess we got it as a favor from one of the DJs. I can't remember which one was that played it, but we heard it and it was like, there we are, you know. And then, of course, you know, when we got a little more popular, we started to get a lot of radio airplay. And then, you know, but it's to this day when a song comes on the radio, you know, I go, yeah, that's right, that's me.
Well, yeah, that must be the best feeling. I mean, even no matter where you are, I don't care. Like, I mean, I hear, I love 80s music too. And I'm at the supermarket and I've interviewed a lot of these guys and I'm like, oh yeah, I know that guy. And it's just, and it makes you, you know, there's nothing, it makes you have fun shopping because you're like, okay, it's better than hearing some bullshit that you don't like. You know, if I hear Don't Fear the Reaper, I'd be like, oh, cool, I'll go. This is good.
Yeah, I once heard a Muzak version of I Love the Night in the Seattle airport. And I'm going, yeah, who did that? That's great.
Now, as you start getting bigger, how does your life change? You know, it's the old thing. I tell people this. It's not, people think being a musician is all fun. But you guys have a grueling schedule. What was the road like for you guys when you were first getting big? And as you said, going from opening for Alice Cooper to going to arenas. How does your life change?
Well, you scale up. I mean, obviously when you're climbing the ladder, it's every new opportunity and effort is, you know, I mean, you just submerge yourself in it because, you know, it's great. Travel has gotten just awful over the last 30, 40 years. It's less fun. You know, flying commercial is less fun. You know, it just seems like everything is just more and more a pain in the butt. But I'd say it's more of an ordeal today than it was in a day. You know, like when you're riding high and you're young, you know, it's you just throw yourself into it. You know, looking back on it, I've got really no regrets for the whole arc and career path of my life. It's been a great ride.
Isn't it funny how, like, you're right, with like traveling back then was easier. It's just like meeting people. Back in the day when you didn't have a cell phone, you'd find your friends. Now you can have cell phones and you don't find them. Like, oh, meet me here. And it's funny because traveling was different then, because it was easier to travel too. There wasn't all the bullshit.
Yeah, you know, there was no need for the security we have now. And then, you know, just it was the whole process was just a lot more casual and relaxed.
Now, SNL did that sketch on Don't Fear the Reaper. After that, did you guys, I talked to Albert Bouchard about this, and he told me it was pretty dead on what happened. But did you guys get a pop in popularity after that? Did you have young people trying to figure out who this band was?
I'd say the Cowbell has been the singular most impactful promotion Blue Oyster Cult has had in its entire career. You know, it's opened us up to a larger swath of audience, especially young people. You know, that their first contact with Blue Oyster Cult was that sketch, and the sketch is a phenomenon just because it's endured as an SNL item. Peacock is doing a four-part series on SNL, and one of the four parts is entirely devoted to the Cowbell sketch. And Eric and I did a long interview with a film crew a few weeks ago about that, and it's just phenomenal to me that the sketch has endured the way it is. And when anybody says something needs more Cowbell, you know exactly what they mean. You know, the whole concept of the sketch is just rippled out into the culture to where it's everybody is sort of hip to it.
Now, when you wrote Don't Fear the Reaper, what was your process? Was it music first, lyrics first? And in your mind, and I know you'll say, well, you never know when you write a song, but did you know that it would be such a lasting song? I mean, I hear that on classic rock on the radio all the time. Did you know when you sat down, what was your whole game plan? Music first, lyrics first, or how did that come about?
The guitar riff, the opening guitar riff came first. And then the first two lines of lyrics sort of just spilled out of my head. And then the idea of the song evolved from that. And it took me about 6 weeks to finish writing the lyric and the story. And you know, creating the bridge and the finish, you know, just making it into a product. You know, I had no thought about you know, the life of the song as it has happened. But you know, Blue Oyster Cult was always an album band. We hadn't had a pop hit, you know, ever. You know, so that was the first song that got on AM radio back, you know, back days. You know, singles came out on AM and album tracks were on FM, of course. And then, so as far as the longevity, no, I had no idea, you know. But right from the beginning, you know, that song was like a ride, you know. When you heard the song, it was like getting on a ride and you just sort of went with the ride, you know. And that's the way it felt even to me as the writer when I wrote it.
Was there any song you wrote that you thought would be like a huge, like not a huge hit, but like you thought would be more acknowledged than it did? Because I'm sure there's certain things where you sit down and you go, man, this is it. And then you go, it doesn't get the acknowledgement. Was there any song that you wrote that you really said it was great?
We had a single in the 80s called Dancing in the Ruins, and I didn't write that song. It was written by outside people, and but to me, it sounded like a Blue Oyster Cult song, and I was surprised that that was not a hit, because to me, it's right in the pocket of what a BOC song should sound like, you know, with my vocal, you know, because there's my vocals and Eric's vocals primarily, although the whole band sang, you know, Albert sang and Joe sang and even Alan Lanier sang, you know. But anyway, that's one song that I think should have gone farther.
Now, how do you decide when you guys were sitting down, you know, and you're writing songs, you're how do you decide who's singing? Like, when you write, do you ever write a song, do you say, like, this is definitely for me or this is for Erica? How do you guys do that? Because you have five people, you know, you have a band that there's egos, but how do you make that work?
Yeah, well, you know, when Eric writes, you know, he writes for himself, you know, and he co-writes with Richie Castellano lately, but he wrote a lot of stuff with Albert Bouchard and the band in the day. And I pretty much write for myself, you know, because I write for my own voice. On Ghost Stories, I sing a song that Albert wrote called The Only Thing That Lasts Forever. And when he wrote that song, he said, Don, you should sing this, you know, so I did, you know, and that's out on this Ghost Stories record.
Who wrote Shot in the Dark on Ghost Stories? Because I like the opening. There's that story. It's cool.
I'd have to look at the credits to remember who wrote that. You know, I'm not sure who wrote the lyric on it. Yeah.
So looking back, you know, give me just a few of the highlights of your career. You know, you've had such a great career, but it's, in 50 years, it's hard to pick out different stuff. But give me a few of your highlights that you feel are very important to you.
To me, like going into a new market, traveling overseas, going to England for the first time, you know, it's like, you know, I'm imagining it's like the Hard Day's Night and the Beatles, you know, and it sort of was in those days, you know, it really was. And you know, going to France, going to Germany, Spain, Italy, going to Japan for the first time was great. I thought we'd be more popular in Japan with Godzilla than we in fact are. You know, I like to go to Japan a lot, but we've only been there 3 times. You know?
Now, Godzilla, whose idea was it to put the big? Because I remember seeing you. I said that's a Spectre man, seeing that mask on Albert, and I was just like, holy! I think it was so cool. Whose idea is that, and how did you lug it around? Because it's a big, cool mask.
Well, it went in a road case, you know, in the day, and I forgot where Albert got that, you know. But of course, it just looked ridiculous on his head. It was really cool, you know.
So, are you going to keep writing, or what is the future for Blue Oyster Cult? Because you've been around for a long time. I mean, what do you guys see the future?
I see, like, you know, a gradual receding from visibility, but we're not going away entirely. You know, I think we've done it for so long, and I still enjoy singing and playing. You know, like traveling, not so much, but I'm getting on in years, so I don't know. I think from now on there's no promises, but you know, I doubt if you've heard the last from me, you know, and or the band.
How many guitars do you have?
How many?
Yeah.
I don't have a ton of them. I probably got about 20, I think, somewhere around there.
Now, does your musician find his favorite guitar, and then how do you pick which one you want to take when you go on the road? Because I mean, do you take all 20? Because that would take up a lot of room.
No, I don't travel with much. I generally play Steinberger guitars since about 1990 on, and my main axe is I call the Cheeseburger because it's got a white body, a sort of a Stratocaster looking body, and it's scalloped out to look like a piece of Swiss cheese. So
now after all this time, what is your favorite song to play? Is there one that you just love playing live, or is it all of them, or what is?
Yeah, I couldn't name one song. No, you know, the BOC's catalog is so good that there's nothing I despise. You know, I don't have to grit my teeth playing anything. You know, so it's good.
Now, when you go on the road, do you have a set list every night, or do you mix it up because you have such a diverse catalog and you have really fans who know your music?
Yeah, Eric likes to create the sets, and of course, you know, we always play the hits. We have to do that, and you know, we've got several you know, favorite pieces that we generally play every night, but we like to mix it up too, just to amuse ourselves and also to give the fans some variety. You know, especially if we're playing multiple nights or if we're coming back to a market, we'll play something different than we did last time we were there.
Before we go, Give me one good rock and roll story from the early BOC days.
I should have thought of something because I don't know. I'd like to help you, Steve, but I don't know if I can come up with anything.
Just give me a good story about one of the biggest arenas you played.
The biggest show we ever played was the Ballpark in San Diego, and that was a festival that we headlined, and that was, I think it was 81 or 83, one of those around that area. You know, and the Ballpark was filled, and it was great. You know, it made the local news. It was a big show. That was the biggest show we ever did.
Well, that's awesome. I want to thank you for coming on. People, go get the album, April 12th, Ghost Stories. It's really good, and it's got a good sound. And if you like BOC, you'll really love it. And go to their website, bluesocult.com. You're still touring. You have a few shows coming up, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. As superstar producer Bruce Dickinson says, you know, we have what appears to be a dynamite sound.
There you go, people. So go check it out. Go to my website, coopertalk.net. You can find 1,001 episodes on there. You can email me at coopertalk.net. Remember, I'm Steve Cooper. I'm only as hip as my guest. Don't forget, drink your water, eat your vegetables, take your vitamins, and I'll talk to you next time.